and you know, so he was to about other things about Achintya to talk about, as you probably may not know, that he was the official tabla player during those days, all these years he was here in the hostel. In fact, that is basically happened because of Rajiv Gawai, because once he heard that Achintya is a tabla player, then he told him that next time when you are going home, if you are not bringing your tabla, you will not be allowed at the hostel. And that's how he brought his tabla. And then, of course, we have a beautiful time, and he was one of the active members of AMA. And in those days, any function in TIFR, you cannot think of without Achintya playing his tabla. And of course, he was also very much interested in classical musics and so on. So that is a different story altogether. And so with that introduction, let me request Achintya to give his talk today. I think yes, that's right. Amma was started that time.
Just.
When you have retired from IGC?
Oh, end of 2012. Well, good afternoon, everyone. As Mr. Satyanarayana said, that for the last 10 minutes, last 15 minutes, I have met so many people, and it's a procession of familiar faces and nostalgia all around. Well, I really feel honored to be here and give a talk on the longitude problem. Before that, I'll just say a few words about the transition from TIFR to ONGC. I was here from 1977 to 82, and I did a rather insignificant PhD from the theoretical physics group here. I mean, it was nothing to much to mention about. In fact, the same year, my batchmate, Dr. N. C. Rana, late Dr. N. C. Rana, was awarded the the award for the best thesis. And my other batchmate is, of course, Professor Mondal. So, and then there are so many other familiar faces. And I joined ONGC immediately after finishing my PhD. So that was in, and I was posted in Baroda. And soon after about 9 months, I was back to Bombay. I'll still call it Bombay because, that time I think it was still called Bombay. I was back, and not only back in ONGC in Bombay, but indirectly to TIFR also. Why? In ONGC, I was posted in the offshore exploration group. I had to go in a ship and sail for 15 days, and for another next 15 days, I was on rest. So that was the terminology used in ONGC. And on top of that, I was assigned the project of creating maps or generating maps of the real-time navigation on the ships. And incidentally, ONGC didn't have a computer resource at that time, and they used to hire the computer time of TIFR. And since my association with TIFR was known, I was quote-unquote sent back to TIFR to work. So that way, my association with all the people here continued till 1992 till I was here in ONGC. So being in ONGC and in offshore exploration, I was associated with, I had to be associated with latitude and longitude. I was a full-fledged sailor that way for 9 years. And after the map projection, then you prepare maps, and I used to prepare it here in TIFR. But then, about this longitude problem, I came to know only in 2011, So I had been dealing with latitude, longitude, this thing, not thing, map projection and what not. But the longitude problem per se, I came to know only in 2011 after a visit to Greenwich. So this is the approach to Greenwich and the Royal Observatory, and I had a natural interest in this, so that's why I made a visit there. And then now I'll ask you to rewind to the beginning of 18th century. And that is how apparently the Royal Observatory looked at that time. And when I was coming out of the Royal Observatory, I found that there was something written longitude problem. But I didn't have much of time left, so I saw a few exhibits and then I had to hurry out. But then it stuck to my mind that then what is a longitude problem? So it may be known to some of you, but my idea is to trace back the history of the problem, which was considered unsolvable till 1700s. And have a glimpse into some intricacies of the art of clockmaking, because as you will see, as we progress, you will see that the solution to the longitude problem is very closely related with the development of horology, the clock and watchmaking. And then at the end I will dwell a bit on one of the first instances of politics in scientific circle. Now exploring the unknown was the desire of man from early days, and with very limited knowledge of their whereabouts, it's really astonishing that with meager knowledge of their whereabouts, they sailed out to unknown destination, the explorer in man. And what was the result? Because of the scanty knowledge of their whereabouts, the shipwrecks. And starvation deaths. They didn't know where they are going, and they used to hover around their destination. And that, after losing their bearing, many people died on board.
Sea exploration became popular than land exploration. In the mankind's history, why it was sea exploration became popular than land exploration? Let us explore through land.
Okay, that's a good question. What I feel is that, simultaneously the map making, that was also going on. People knew where the land masses were, where are the water masses, okay? Simultaneously this was going on. And the land exploration, if you see that Livingstone and others, that was in the 15th century, 15th and 16th century, okay? So land explorations were already going on. And then came with gradual exploration, they ventured out into the sea. Somehow they came to know that the East is very resourceful in raw material. So simultaneously with the Industrial Revolution, they needed the raw materials. So they came to know that the raw materials are abundant, etc. Yeah, of course, but his question was why. Anyway, but by that time there was a lot of exploration of the land masses also.
But is it the fall of Roman Empire, Eastern Roman Empire, one of the main reasons why they had to explore sea routes if they want to come to East?
Okay.
So then they could go through
okay.
country,
etc. Right. And all these for not knowing the ship's location and more importantly, the longitude. Why more important? We'll see. The starvation deaths were possibly maximum during the marathon voyage from 50 degrees north 250 degrees south. Just imagine, people venturing out from northern hemisphere to the end of the southern hemisphere. And that is what is the trajectory. So even after, you know, going below the tip of South America, so their target was one Juan Fernandez island, and they just hovered around that for the lack of knowledge of the longitude. So they reached here, the latitude one could know and show that. And after coming here, they just hovered around, and a lot of people died because of this. Because already they were, you know, quite a few days in the sea. So that is what happened. And then the shipwrecks. There were quite a few shipwrecks, but then the real disaster was in 1707, when after defeating the French army, the Royal Navy was triumphantly coming back, and the flagship Association sank along with three others, four ships, against Scilly Islands of English coast. And this anecdote appeared very interesting to me. So one sailor somehow could, you know, guess by his reckoning, by his own reckoning, that we might crash against that. So he said that, and since it went against the general consensus on board, he was hanged by the captain. And that is the location of the Scilly disaster. So they were coming and just about to land, and then that's what happened. So Admiral Chauvel and others died. And after this, there was a huge public uproar that why, in spite of so many learned people, so many, you know, discoveries and inventions, why this is happening repeatedly. So then the Board of Longitude was formed with Sir Isaac Newton, then the President of the Royal Society, at its head. So you can see the gravity of the situation. The British Parliament passed Longitude Act, and then a prize money of £20,000, huge amount, declared in 1714, and we just missed the 300 years range. We are in 301 years now, but anyway. To anyone who could determine the longitude of a place within half a degree, and which translates to about 55 kilometers near the equator, half a degree in terms of the longitudes. And actually, interestingly, there was a gradation in the prize. It was considered so much difficult at that time that this gradation was introduced: 10,000, 15,000, 20,000. And just for your ready reckoner, that 1 degree of longitude is 110 kilometers. So you can see the amount of accuracy, only 55 kilometers is being asked for. Rather, as much as 55 kilometers asked for. And this is, you know, just, I thought it will be interesting to people, the passing of Longitude Act, the late 1917-13. And here it's described the gradation of that longitude prize, and then this part shows the constitution of the Board of the Longitude. Isaac Newton is there. Then John Flamsteed. And you know, all of you know that there was a lot of tension between John Flamsteed and Isaac Newton before and after the publication of Principia. So Newton wanted all the data at once, and Flamsteed said that I'm not yet ready. And there was a lot of tension between them. And of course, there are, you know, First Lord of Admiralty, Speaker of the House, etc., etc., and eminent professors of mathematics at Oxford and Cambridge. So high power, you know, board formed. And they could look like this. Now, I mean, for the audience here, this and then also people knew, and this solution of the longitude problem is easy in principle because of this. So in terms of longitude extent, that will be equivalent to this much time difference and this much distance. So one knew all that. But then nobody knew the solution in practice, because nobody knew how to determine time accurately, particularly during a voyage in the wobbling ship. So one knew that if I know the time correctly, I can predict the longitude with respect to a reference. But how to find the time? So thus, the problem of determining longitude is identical to the problem of determining time accurately. And notice this watch, I noticed this clock, I couldn't resist the temptation of showing you a 24 hour clock. Normally you see 12 hour clocks, so that is what it is. So on the other hand, so we know that longitude was a big problem. But on the other hand, the people knew to find longitude of a place for centuries. So this figure clearly shows that elevation of the pole star is the latitude of the place. One knows that. And alternatively, the inclination of the sun's trajectory will also give you the latitude of the place. So this was well known. But for determination of longitude, there is no such natural reference as the equator for the latitude, because as you know, by rotational symmetry, the zero can be anywhere. Now someone asked me that, okay, longitude zero of longitude is at Greenwich, but how accurate is this now at the moment? So you have a line, I'll show that in the next slide. But then I found out that now they have a laser from the observatory, so that marks the zero of the longitude. Earlier it was this. I mean, that is what people do. They stand across the holy divide. And many of, I mean, most of you know that after several counter claims, Greenwich became the became accepted as the zero of longitude. There are many other countries who stake their claim. In any case, the difference of local times will translate into the difference in longitude. So the question is, how to measure the time difference? You are here, and so you can estimate the local time at noon from the highest elevation of the sun, and then know the time back home. So that is the main problem, time back home, over from where you started, T0. So what is the ways? What are the ways? Either by taking an accurate clock on board from the starting point, that is the natural thing to do, and this is the horological solution. And since that was not viable that time, so indirectly from the celestial observation, the astronomical solution. So there are two things. One is horological solution, the other is the astronomical solution, or the lunar distance method. So the competition between the two. Now, till the beginning of the 18th century, there was no accurate clock that could cope up with the rolling and pitching of a vessel, as I already mentioned, and the variation of temperature, of course. And the pendulum clock will, pendulum clocks were around, but they will definitely not work on the ship. And on the other hand, the science of astronomy and law of gravitation, which was well developed by that time. So thus the scientists, marine captains and admirals strongly believed that that was the only solution possible, the astronomical solution. So let us briefly see what was the astronomical solution. So the moon passes over the celestial bodies and it completes the revolution. So in principle, one thought, you can take the moon as the clock hand as it passes across the stars and reading the time from the moon. Of course is hard, but it seemed to be the viable solution. So the astronomers and others, they started working on that using the moon's motion. Okay, and how does the lunar distance work? Basically, you measure the angle between a bright star like Regulus and the moon. You can take another star also, and so using a sextant you measure that angle between the Regulus or some such star and the moon. So that is why it's called lunar distance. And then at that moment, anyone on the surface of the earth who can see the same two bodies will observe the same angle after measuring, after correcting for the parallax error. And then comes the painstaking part, that there is a predetermined almanac, and from there, by comparing the lunar distance with the tabulated values, one finds the Greenwich time for that observation. So this was predicted by whoever created those lunar tables using astronomical knowledge and the law of gravitation. One could predict the celestial positions. And accurate star charts were already prepared by the hard work of these people. And this is a typical nautical almanac. And then comes the lunar distance table. So you have all this, you know, what is the, this is the time, and these are the angle between moon and the particular stars. You have the table before you, then you look up the angle. So when the angle matches, you read out the time by the interpolation. So it's an indirect kind of method, but that was the only solution that time. Significant contributors, of course, Isaac Newton and these people, and then inventors of course, instruments like sextant. But then this man, I have read in the literature that this man, Tobias Mayer, along with Euler, Euler had a hand in this also. So Tobias Mayer supposed to have done great contribution to this creating of the lunar distance table, very accurate, along with Euler. And they got, you know, some amount for the as a prize also. We'll see that. And then this man, you note down this man, Neville Maskelyne. He also made a lot of contribution, and he was the Astronomer Royal later on. And just, you know, in case people are interested, I just tabulated this. Who was the Astronomer Royal when? So this is about the time the problem start, I mean the people looking at the time finding problem, and then he was the Astronomer Royal around this time. We'll quickly go through the features of the lunar distance method. Obviously needs a lot of observation and computational skill, untenable in inclement weather. If you cannot observe, you cannot do anything. And of course, that was improved considerably during 18th century because of contribution of different people. But it never possibly reached the accuracy criterion set by the Board of Longitude. So it was hovering around that, but it didn't go below that, as you can imagine from the table. But still, it was used till 19th century. You know, you'll see that the other method became viable in the middle to the end of 18th century. But then it was this method was in use till 19th century because of the high cost of the watchmaking or the clock making. So compared to that, that was less costly. So that's why navigators still use that.
How much did it reach by that time? Mm-hmm. Never reached the accuracy criteria, mm-hmm. But what was the accuracy reached? I mean, the table that you showed.
Yeah.
Typically had what?
Typically, like 1 degree. Half a degree is 55 kilometers. So it was between, yeah. So that is why they did get some prize money. They did get some prize money.
They would have still missed the islands.
Hmm?
They would have still missed the islands.
Exactly. In fact, later on, both were used simultaneously, when till one took over the other. You know, people used to, whatever the horological method decisions, so that was corroborated by the lunar observation also. So some, you know, there was a cooperative thing between the two. Can you talk a bit louder?
Even if you are observing the moon and using this lunar distance method, you need to be able to follow up that definition of time, something which is a local clock on board.
Yeah.
Because you can't keep observing the moon every instant and telling what the time is from that.
Yeah. So
you make one accurate measurement, and then you use something to interpolate. So they had clocks of a good...
Yeah, later on, when the clocks or the watches were...
No, not good enough to reach the lunar distance thing, but once you made an astronomical observation, you would still need to be able to project time for the next 1 hour or 2 hours or something. So, you had a clock...
The so-called, in fact, that is what we used as a sailor also, because when I sailed in early, say, 83, so that time something, there is some terminology we used to say called dead reckoning. So the satellites were not very frequent that time. So one used to go by Doppler sonar for the speed and the gyroscope for the direction. So that is called dead reckoning. So you don't have any other choice. You have to go by dead reckoning. So whenever you get an observation, and then you can try to correct that. So that is how it all went.
So clocks of some other kind which were functional to produce for you, you know, baseline which was shorter and which you could depend upon.
No. Because clocks came later. So what you were saying happened after the clocks were on board. But before that, one had to go by the lunar distance method only. That is before 1750.
Only of short measurements for that. The sand clocks and such things were used for a long time,
Which one?
Sand clocks have been used for, in use for a long time for short range.
Maybe for short range, but they used to go for high, long distances. Okay, so far we looked at the astronomical method. Now we turn to the horological solution, or the art of clockmaking, and that now seems to be the natural choice. I mean, people started doing that. But as I said, nobody knew how to make a clock or watch that would keep accurate time during a voyage. Pendulum clocks were there, but they would not work at all in a wobbling ship. Then came this man. John Harrison, a self-taught Yorkshire carpenter, proposed design for a practical marine clock. So this is happening around 1720. Just remember that. He started working on that. And he said, my clock will do this. Could withstand rolling and pitching of a marine vessel and automatically compensate for the effects of temperature. And obviously, if this happens, then it will circumvent the need for painstaking observation and reference to pre-calculated almanacs. Simple. So now it is only technological innovation. So his devices had all the complexity of the longitude problem already hardwired into the design. And in an earlier era, Harrison might have been accused of a witchcraft for proposing such a magic box solution to the people who are used to only astronomical observation. And to appreciate Harrison's ingenuity, let us consider the clock, how it, the pendulum clocks before John Harrison, which was not possible to take on the ship. And that will we'll discuss the basic functions of a clock. So this is the source of energy, the falling weight. You wind it up, then it falls and then drives the mechanism. So that is the source of energy. this is the power gears to drive the clock hands, several gears. And here comes an important part of it, the anchor escapement and the controller. So the pendulum is the controller, and in fact both of these form a cooperative thing, that this, the escapement, which we'll discuss in the next slide, the escapement controls the pendulum, because that we'll see, and then the pendulum also controls this. So there is a cooperative phenomenon between the two. We'll see that. So just remember that pendulum was the controller, and this is the escapement, which doesn't allow all the energy to to be transferred to the power gears all at a time. And this is the whole assembly with the time indicator. Now here comes the anchor escapement and the pendulum. So as the pendulum swings from side to side, it rocks the escapement, and then it locks and unlocks this so that it can move. In other words, let it escape once per second. The pendulum moves, and pendulum with time, there is a the frictional thing due to which the time period may slow down, but then the escapement gives an extra nudge to that, so that makes the pendulum go in a regular interval, and this makes sure that it transfers the energy once per second. So there is a cooperative phenomena between this pendulum and the escapement, and from this locking and unlocking, you used to hear the tick-tock sound in the pendulum clock.
So I think you might have amplitude.
Pardon me?
Not the time period was slowing down. You're talking about the amplitude of the pendulum reducing. This feedback mechanism essentially keeps the pendulum.
Okay, so make the time period. Yeah.
Time period doesn't slow down. Actually, the time period will increase if the.
You are correct. So there is an interactive thing between the two, the escapement and the controller. So now we'll see the transition from before John Harrison's time to after. We'll see with a watch, but then in between there is another step, the clock, and then finally the watch. But we'll see the transition from this clock to the the more modern watch mechanism. The source of energy is replaced by a spring, essentially. So the power gear looks like that inside your watch. Now the main thing is that the anchor escapement is replaced by the other escapement, and the controller pendulum is replaced by the balance spring. This is the balance spring, and this is the escapement and controller, and the whole assembly with the time indicator. So we had the pendulum and the anchor escapement, and Harrison's innovations in particular were the pendulums as controller replaced by the interlinked bar balances for stability. So the bar balance, artificial gravity, time period, and then the anchor escapement. There was this lubrication which was required, and he did away with that lubrication business with that anchor escapement by this grasshopper kind of. And that is how the first clock came into shape, the first C clock designed by John Harrison, H1. Still it is a clock, remember, but these mechanisms shift. So testing, naturally that was to be put on test. It was done with a trip to Lisbon, a week's journey. And not only did it meet the criterion, it also predicted correctly some sighted land, so that another disaster was avoided. And that was, appreciated by the captain. And that is what, where it was about to happen. And after this grand success of the first clock, the board of longitude met for the first time after its inception, because there was no significant, proposal before that. And the funny thing is, I read that there were weird kind of, proposals given before the board of longitude as a solution. So one can read through all that. And again, I was, very impressed by this Cambridge University archive, and they have made it public that one sees the minutes of the meeting, and these are the eminent people who are there in the board meeting. But in the meeting, Harrison played down the performance of his baby, citing some defects he wanted to correct. And he promised to produce another better, and in the process ended up getting only 250 pounds. So that's why I say he could possibly have claimed the whole prize money that eluded him later for many, many years. I'll just quickly go through the intermediate developments. This is the H2 he tried, but then he himself was dissatisfied. Then he started work on H3, and he put a lot of confidence in this. He was sure that this will win him the, he was convinced that it will win him the longitude prize. But then just before it was to be put on test, he said, no, I have found out another thing, why this is not going much beyond the accuracy level. So he, while manufacturing H3, he said that I am convinced that its solution is in another design altogether, and that is the, he concluded that the lack of desired success level of the C clocks, that the balances, though large, didn't vibrate quickly enough to confer the property of stability in timekeeping. Now this figure will tell you that. So these bar balances, they are during the time period of 1 second roughly, whereas this balance spring, that is 5 times faster, and the spring that gives the stability in this. But the 1 second is done through that, with the escapement. It's quickly vibrating, but what is being transmitted through the escapement is 1 second. So now, old pendulum clock to another intermediate level of clock.
He also invent something for temperature compensation?
Yeah. So that is where it is. So these are the bimetal stuff. This is the bimetal stuff, which he introduced at this level also, but I didn't get a detailed picture of that. But from here you can see this is the bimetal strip, which will take care of that, the temperature So now you clock to the contemporary pocket watch. So these are the specifications, and this was proudly presented by Harrison to the board of longitude, but little did he realize that he has been quite late in doing that, 1760. So this voyage was now longer, and it did again meet the accuracy criteria, and it amounted just under 2 minutes. 2 minutes means again half a degree. 2 minutes of time is like half a degree in a period of more than 5 months. So this was good enough, all these, after 81 days, and the total was 5 months. So, and this was the trajectory. So again, not only did it meet the criterion, but then this island, from there they wanted to take fresh provisions. So the captain thought it is far off, but then it rightly predicted that it is very close by. So the provision was taken, and on the way back. So the prize should have gone to him right then, but then started the period of intrigue and the politics. He was paid only 1500 pounds and board concluded in its report the tests were not sufficient to determine the longitude at sea. So and they started imposing more and more conditions. So even after the second successful trip to those islands, as I showed you, it offered to hand over only half the reward money on condition that Harrison hand over all the clocks and the full disclosure of the magnificent clockwork inside H4. And to receive the full amount, etc., etc. Production of not only one but two duplicate copies of H4. More and more conditions. And the possible reason could be this, that dominated by astronomers, and they may have found it difficult to accept that a carpenter of by profession could snatch the prize from them.
Nobody else after the first design started working on
clocks. Actually after the watch was prepared, there are people like, as you will see, the Kendall and others, they made innovation which brought down the price later on. Because during this time, the lunar distance method didn't improve much because there was no provision actually beyond that. It has reached its limit. So he dejected Harrison prepared H5, etc. And desperate for recognition and rightfully feeling that they deserved the remaining prize money, his son William Harrison sought the support of King George III. He was magnanimous enough to test this H5 in his own observatory, and finally this resulted in a parliamentary debate and the award to Harrison the remaining prize money in April 1773 as a bounty from the parliament, not as the coveted prize. Now some of you may be interested to know how much money, who got how much money. So Tobias Mayer, apart from him, tops the list with 3000. His contributions, I read that is very significant. And then there are other, Euler got a paltry amount of 300, but he had his hand in, he worked with Tobias Mayer. And then this man Kendall, as I said, he for construction of a copy of Harrison's H4. And for John Harrison, ultimately total amount he got was 24,000 pounds. But that is not the way he wanted it. Anyway, now the summary I'll skip because we have already discussed, but this is in one place. And I bring in one slide of Captain Cook just to pay tribute to this man, who was responsible for discovering all these southern places, the Terra Australis, and also because he was entrusted by the Board of Longitude to compare lunar distance method with the performance of K1. Now it is K1 because Kendall had improvement and he made it cheaper. And you will see another reason for it, this is K1. So he took that and he was very much impressed by K1 and he wanted to carry it later on also. He carried it in his fateful third expedition, but unfortunately he was killed by the natives of Hawaii. Now history has it that Neville Maskelyne, who was the astronomer royal later on, he tried to deny in connivance with the other board members who were admirals and other astronomers and professors, tried to deny or delay the prize money Harrison so rightfully deserved. He said to have influenced the Board of Longitude to ground H4, this is another reason, ground H4 so that Captain Cook was forced to take K1, the copy of this, to take the credit away from him. And he is also said to have, there is documentary evidence for this, that forceful possession of all the clocks H1 to H4 which languished in neglect in Royal Observatory for many years, till this man restored Harrison timekeepers to glory around 1935. So if any one of you go, happen to go to Greenwich, you can see all these in the display, H1 to H5. I want to have a look at that if I happen to go there next time. So thus Harrison spent 45 years to develop his timekeepers and another 15 years to persuade the establishment that a working class tradesman with little formal education had really designed a clock that succeeded where every effort of the noble and great had failed. So for a balanced view, I must, you know, put forward the other points of view also. Some people say that masculine, after all, was not as villainous as painted by some others. So he strongly believed that, you know, with improvements in accuracy, etc., this can be a practical solution. On the other hand, William Harrison, that is John Harrison's son, suggested that masculine had sabotaged the trial of his father's watch, etc., and that is why Masculine was sent to Barbados by the Board of Longitude to assess the reliability of his sea watch in 1763. So there are counter allegations. Nor is there any evidence of prejudice against Harrison, and he regarded Harrison as a genius of the first rate, and his sea watch was brilliant but expensive. So he believed that he felt the lunar method was a better bet, a good sextant and a lunar distanceable cost only 20 pounds compared to that. So whatever be the stories, we salute those great scientific minds who solved this problem in their own ways. And at the same time, let us pay tribute to those intrepid voyagers who ventured out into the high seas, because that was the reason for all these development and the accurate clocks and watches. And now fast forward to the present. So used to this kind of things, it's very difficult to believe that the determination of longitude can at all be a problem. In fact, when I talked to some people, they said, was that really a problem? So very difficult to imagine. And before finishing, I'll just give you some facts about the GPS, which, you know, gives the coordinates of your car almost every second. There are 32 satellites in the GPS constellation. At an altitude of approximately 20,000 kilometers, 6 orbital planes with 4 satellites each, and there are some spares, inclination of that much, an orbital period half a day. Now it so happened that the natural satellite had to accept defeat from the tiny device. However, its artificial counterparts triumphed in continuously fixing the longitude, and now you can get an accuracy of about a meter definitely, and even centimeters in case of the military applications. So that is how the situation now at present. So these are the references. I was very much delighted to see the Cambridge University archives, and particularly since they are made public. And whose name is not here, I want to acknowledge my maternal uncle, who took me to Greenwich actually on my visit to England, to London. he took me there. And then I fondly remember batchmate Dr. N.C. Rana, late Dr. N.C. Rana, who taught me basic astronomy along the seashore here in TIFR. And of course, I acknowledge the ASSET colloquium organizers, and in particular, Professor N.K. Mondal, my dear friend. And thanks everyone in the audience for their patience.
Thank you.
Why was the watch so expensive?
Can you talk a bit louder?
H1 to H4. Why was it so expensive? Was it really the raw material at that time, or is it the amount of labor which went into it?
Yeah, I think so. The basic raw material plus the effort that went into it. But of course, he himself did it. But then
it won so many years.
No, I know, but I think
no factory assembly line.
Artificial cost, right? Because
hand tooling at that time.
Yeah, in fact, he made.
Was it that he could not? He was the only
those
person.
Those gears had to be made.
Yeah.
All those things handcrafted.
Handcrafted.
Can you imagine? Make a screw yourself.
So you go to you go to cottage industry.
So maybe I didn't phrase my question. So obviously, the first person who has to make a prototype is very expensive. But this was being imagined as an application, because you had talked about some arguments they were making for the lunar method being eventually being cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they didn't understand the economies of scale and things like that. But
one is to
had a team.
No, the mass production of those things was already well established. Charts could be mass produced.
Yeah, yeah.
And sextants were already mass produced. Whereas this was just entering production.
But weighing against the accuracy required. So that was not there. But then after, you know, Harrison did divulge his secrets. So there were many copies made. So many, many watchmakers were working at the same time. So that is why it became cheaper later on. So after all, he had to sustain himself.
So, if you look at the history, a lot of the initial developments are happening by, you know, a bunch of Brits, right? But how does watchmaking eventually go to Switzerland?
Well, that's a very good question. In fact, that will instigate me to look into this really.
Next person.
No, that's a very good, in fact, a few days back I was going through the websites, then I found
Rolex, right? Rolex is founded in London, eventually shifts to Switzerland, and most of these very complex mechanical watches are all Swiss watches.
Mm-hmm. But the only reason I can give you at the moment is they are so much at peace with themselves in Switzerland, possibly they can they can concentrate on doing that. That's the only argument I can give.
They could combine the German precision with French style.
Oh yes, great.
Yeah,
just one side comment. Last year, in 2014, Harrison's statue was eventually established in the Westminster Abbey to honor 300 years after he done it. Now they have a statue of Harrison in Westminster Abbey in Buckingham.
Oh, is it? Oh, that's good.
For the tricentenary.
Oh, I see.
For the tricentenary, last year they eventually.
Okay, so that adds one more place to my possible itinerary.
You mentioned some minutes. Did you have a chance to look at those minutes?
The minutes? Yeah, yeah.
I'm curious to know how, for a prize which was announced, the conditions could be manipulated by the committee members without writing it in the minutes.
But anything, you see, the politicking started even then. I mean,
all
there could have been instances before that as well.
Art of committology is
new. Any other questions? Okay. If not, let us once again thank Dr. Nepal.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure, my pleasure.